Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. This podcast is also sponsored by DocketWise, an all-in-one immigration forms and case management solution trusted by thousands of immigration lawyers across the U.S. I really like DocketWise. It makes immigration applications easy by allowing the clients to provide information through simple online questionnaires that are shareable by text or email and available in multiple languages. Not only that, DocketWise provides a comprehensive group of case management features, including invoicing and calendaring, secure messaging, task management, and a lot more. You can learn all about DocketWise and receive a 10% discount on your subscription by heading to docketwise.com/immigration-review, so they know we sent you. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. We are a litigious people. I decided to speak to two of the most litigious among us in late February. Trina Realmuto has been on the forefront of non-citizen advocacy for a long time. She currently serves as executive director of the National Immigration Litigation Alliance, a relatively new but powerful organization designed to protect, enforce, and expand the rights of non-citizens and individuals perceived to be non-citizens through federal court litigation and, get this, to empower immigration lawyers with the support, skills, and guidance needed to pursue these goals. As you'll hear, if district court or appellate federal litigation is something you're interested in, a talk with Trina or her NILA colleagues is a must. All of the links in the show notes. And of course, I couldn't do this without my trusted KKTP partner, Eddie Ramos. Eddie's old news to many of you, having filled in for me on multiple episodes, and he had one or two special episodes of his own already. But suffice it to say, he's the man, and at KKTP, he focuses on litigating immigration-related cases in federal court. That includes a TPS employment authorization lawsuit that we're co-counseling with Trina and Nyla and other entities. So let's talk lit, folks. Whether you're new to federal litigation or a seasoned advocate, it might be time to dust off those skills. November cometh. Good evening, Eddie and Trina. How are you both doing tonight? Let's start with that.
I'm doing great. Thanks, Kevin.
And Trina?
Pretty good. Thanks.
I'm here with Eddie Ramos and Trina Realmuto on the night of February 29th, 2024. We're going to talk about a lot of things tonight, mostly class actions, federal court litigation, and the National Immigration Litigation Alliance, also known as NILA. It's going to be a great episode. Thank you so much. Both of you are on the East Coast. I'm on the West Coast, if listeners don't know that already and are probably sick of hearing me brag about it. So that makes it late in your time zone right now. So thanks for hanging out with me tonight.
Absolutely, Kevin.
Before we jump into everything, I'm sure that long time or really even short time listeners know about Eddie. But Eddie, remind us who you are.
So I'm Eddie Ramos. I'm a partner at the Kurzban Law Firm. I've been with the firm since I graduated from law school, and here we are in 10, 11 years later.
And the best part of your job has been the subbing in to host the Immigration Review podcast. True or false?
The rumors are true.
The rumor was just me, but now it has been broadcast nationwide, worldwide. Thank you, Eddie. But Trini, you're new. You're the newbie to the podcast. Although you are one of the most respected and known individuals in the entire immigration world. But who are you? Please.
Yeah, tell us. Blessing on a podcast.
You can't.
Thank you for that. I am currently the executive director of the National Immigration Litigation Alliance, which is a newly formed 2020 immigrant rights organization. And as you alluded to, I've been doing immigration and litigation for what seems like a really long time now.
I thought you were about to say, as you alluded to, I'm a boss.
Your words, not mine.
What were you doing before the National Immigration Litigation Alliance was created?
Mary Kenny and I started NILA, we worked together at the American Immigration Council. Before that, so we were directing attorneys at AIC. Before that, I was the litigation director at the National Immigration Project, National Lawyers Guild. And before that, I actually worked abroad for a while. I lived in London and Switzerland and worked for what was then called the American Law Foundation, which is the precursor agency to AIC. And I did some immigrant visa and non-immigrant visa work at consulates and embassies. Before that, I was an associate attorney at Vanderhout in San Francisco.
For all of you not in the know, Trina has just name-dropped like all the most important immigration entities, except Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli, and Pratt. And I might actually be doing an AIC interview in the coming months. So this is actually going to be litigation, immigration, special episode, second quarter 2024. Kind of just rolls off the tongue, that title. So I'm happy to kick it off with you and Eddie. And immigration litigation is no joke, and like all litigation, it's very time-consuming. Is that true or false?
That is true. I think Eddie would agree. 100%.
So please tell me more about NILA. I am interested in NILA, admittedly, and a bit embarrassingly, I don't know enough about it, and I know it's kind of new. What is NILA? Why does it exist? And what do you guys do?
I am happy to share with your listeners a little bit about our organization. And so I'd like to thank you, Kevin, for that opportunity. As I mentioned, we're founded in 2020. So right around the Trump time period.
I remember him.
And we started it really because it was apparent before, but increasingly apparent that the federal judiciary was going to put the brakes on some of these draconian policies that we were seeing from the Trump administration. And we were also seeing that the immigration bar, more than ever, needed to be able to have the confidence and skills to litigate in federal court for their clients on an individual basis. And what we were trying to do was get an organization, devote this organization to immigration litigation. And so the gist of what we try to do is we try to litigate ourselves and with immigration attorneys, but also educate the immigration bar about how to litigate, because our philosophy is basically that the better the litigation skills of the immigration bar, the more we can move the needle in the federal courts for non-citizens. And we were realizing that there's a lot of people who do a lot of representation before EYR and the agencies, but there's a hesitation sometimes to go into federal court, right? Attorneys are familiar with the INA, but when you go to federal court, you have to talk about, 8 USC. So it's a bit of a different language. It can be scary, it can be intimidating, and NILA is really all about helping people develop the skills and confidence so that they can litigate in federal court. And, our core programs are devoted to that, achieving that goal.
Well, there's a bit of a hesitation, I think, for good reason. Substantively, an immigration attorney should know the law. But it's not just immigration. For everyone, federal court is scary. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it's predominantly, or in a lot of ways, the big firms that are there with lots of attorneys and lots of support staff and lots of individuals to write and draft the many, many, many briefs that are required if you're going to bring a claim in federal court. the amount of filings, the rules required, the motions back and forth. It takes a lot of effort. It takes entire teams. And
I think that if you're not a little bit afraid to go to a federal court or a lot afraid, that's not good. You should be, right? Because that fear sort of drives the preparedness of the cases. And folks who have that fear, who are, you know, going to do everything they can to prepare, they're the ones that I think are trying to do right by their clients.
But the only way to get over that fear, and I have fear, that feeling at the pit of my stomach anytime I go into any court, including immigration court, is preparedness. And that's what Nyla helps attorneys do, right? How do you guys do that?
So as I mentioned, I think we have some core programs, but they sort of divide along the lines of litigation and education. And so when we're working with immigration attorneys, we have a unique co-counseling program whereby we partner with immigration attorneys who are new to litigation, or they might be a more experienced attorney but have never done a certain type of litigation. And so what we do is we partner with them, we go into federal court as their co-counsel, and we help them with the substantive work and the procedural aspects of the case. And basically, they have the benefit of our experience and mentorship right there on their individual case with them. And so the goal is to litigate a petition for review with someone, or a FOIA case, or a damages case, so that they can see what's involved. And after their experience with us, hopefully, they'll feel more comfortable doing it again, perhaps by themselves, or, you know, perhaps with us again. So that's one way that we work on litigation skills with attorneys. But the other program that we have for NILA members is this one-on-one strategic assistance program, whereby they will join NILA and reach out to us either by phone or email, and we'll set up, you know, a time to talk by Zoom or phone or whatever. And we'll just talk about their case and we'll strategize about what needs to be done. And if we can't answer the question, we will connect the person with someone who we think can. And those members also have access to our pleading review program, whereby we'll review the complaint. It's their first mandamus. We'll review it. We'll provide high-level comments and edits to complaints or opening briefs or habeas petitions or motions to reopen, whatever the case is. And we charge a little fee for that, but it gives people the benefit of having a second set of eyes on that document before it goes to federal court. And then, of course, you know, we are putting out practice advisories that are publicly available on our website. Whether or not you're a NILA member, it's right there on immigrationlitigation.org. And we also put out templates. So we make those available in Word so people can download them and not have to reinvent the wheel. And then last year, we started doing webinars. And Eddie was a guest presenter on one of our webinars. And those are topics related to federal court litigation.
All of those things are so helpful, are so important. If I was devising a program to help immigration attorneys be federal court litigators, I would do all of the things that you just mentioned, especially that co-counseling program. The strategic assistance stuff, that's very, very important. And the line edits of a complaint, that's great. But to have experienced attorneys second chairing, whether it's virtual or actually in court with an individual, it's just kind of a warm blanket. I would like that in federal court, even no matter how many times you've done it, just to have someone there who you can look to and who can say, yeah, you're doing it right. That's just, or shut up, you're winning. Something like that. That's so important for federal court, no matter what stage you are at.
I think so. Even if we're doing the heavy lifting for some people, they want to know what the experience is like so they can just see what it's like to do a petition for review from start to finish and know what's involved before they take on that experience for themselves.
Can either of you, Eddie or Trina, both of you, explain why federal district court litigation is an important tool for immigration attorneys to think about adding to their toolbox?
Yeah, sure. So many other types of decisions in the immigration realm are only reviewable in as an initial matter in district court. So, for example, I-130 petition denials, or almost every visa, every category of visa petition denials, those are going to get reviewed by a federal district court in a challenge under the Administrative Procedure Act. So for certain types of decisions, you have to start out in district court.
Or you just let USCIS have the last word.
Exactly. And you know, some of the district court review has become more challenging, as Kevin and I both well know, since Patel, especially, you know, with adjustment of status decisions that have become more difficult to get review on in district court. Although there are some promising signs, I guess, for people trying to push back on that. But yeah, it's just a different experience, I guess. You know, both of them are federal court, but you know, the district court practice has a little bit of a different rhythm and a different set of procedures. And so it takes a little bit of getting used to, but it's definitely also a valuable toolkit for folks that are handling the types of decisions that can't go up on petition for review.
And even within district court, different types of cases have a different rhythm. Like, we do a fair bit of work under the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA cases, whether it be for individual case files or for some type of policy, or now we're doing a bunch of proactive disclosure lawsuits to force the agencies to publicly disclose documents that we think should be on their websites and available. You know, those types of cases have a totally different rhythm than a habeas, where a person's been detained and you might be doing more expedited briefing. And then the other thing that we do a fair bit of increasingly now are damages cases under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And that is really going to test your discovery skills or give you an opportunity to learn discovery skills, unlike in a FOIA case, which doesn't usually involve discovery.
There are so few ways to get damages against the U.S. government. The FTCA maybe is the only one, because Bivens doesn't exist. But money talks, you know, that it, through actions like that is how you can affect change. If the federal government knows that if it does something, it's going to get sued and money is going to be paid out, that is a way to get any type of administration to maybe change their policy. So that's very important too. Not to mention, it could provide attorney's fees, which is a vehicle for all types of litigation, if there's money to be made.
In FOIA cases too, I think that there's a pretty generous recovery provision for fees under the FOIA.
I'm not going to sit up here though and promote FOIA lawsuits on this podcast. Those lawsuits are so in the weeds. There are so many statutes and regulatory exceptions and executive order exceptions and arguments for all these exemptions. I don't ever want to even smell a FOIA lawsuit for the rest of my life. So Trina, great work on Nyla for like taking that torch and just going forward on immigration FOIA, because you can't pay me to do them. And we've been paid to do them. And just to be clear, if you want to pay us to do it, we'll do it. But I will not be happy about it.
Well, fees are an important aspect of nonprofit, of our little nonprofit to sustain themselves, you know, to sustain the organization and keep the lights on. So, you know, to Eddie's point about EJA and FOIA, you know, they do help keep the lights on. And I couldn't agree more on most FOIA suits, but I will say that one of our impact suits, the Nightingale class action, was the first ever certified FOIA class action that forced the government to actually produce a file FOIA requests, you know, within the quote statutory timeframe. And, you know, we post on our website their quarterly compliance reports, which we are only getting because the district court judge issued a permanent injunction telling them to stop violating FOIA and to produce those reports. So,
I mean, that was a great win substantively, but I actually talked to Zachary Nightingale at the AILA California conference last year. I was like, you know, congratulations on the win for you. And he said to me, he's like,
I always knew I was going to get into Ira's book somehow. And if it had to be me being a plaintiff and a lawsuit to get in there, so be it. That's what he said. So, I mean, you know, tongue in cheek, it's a great win, but also your former Vanderhoot colleague, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep. And I always thought that he would be my lawyer someday, but I got to be his lawyer first.
You know, before we get to the other reason I wanted to have you both on, the pending lawsuit that you guys are co-counseling together on, just talking about Patel, Eddie, really quick, and to take a very wonky tangent, the case before the Supreme Court right now that's being referred to as Patel 2, really about, you know, where is the line between Patel and Guerrero Lasprilla about mixed questions of law and fact and review? I haven't been following the case. Is there any way that a favorable decision in that case will alleviate some of our concerns about jurisdiction stripping at the district court level? Or did Patel really shut that door on adjustment of status review in district court? Is there any way a favorable finding will help?
Well, I don't see a favorable finding in that case really impacting the question of reviewability in district court.
No.
Because that decision, or the pending case in the Supreme Court, I think it's Wilkinson.
Yeah,
has to do with you know, what is the line between a question of fact and a question of law for purposes of the cancellation of removal, and is the extremely unusual hardship determination. Once you are operating on a accepted set of facts, is the question of the ultimate standard of a question of fact or law? And the district court question has to do with whether you can even get review of legal issues, and the district courts, many district courts have been holding that there is no review even of questions of law, because the exception for review of legal and constitutional claims, the text seems to imply that it's only reviewable on petitions for review. And as we just discussed a few minutes ago, the claims that arise in district court are not arising on petitions for review. But apart from Wilkinson, there have been a few, I think, successful claims brought in district court and on some interesting legal theories. So hopefully those legal theories will eventually win the day, and we may end up with a true Patel 2 for district court purposes at some point in the future. We'll have to wait and see.
Because the district court part of Patel 1 really just is Justice Barrett offhandedly saying something in one sentence and us all reading the implications about based on how the INA is written, but it wasn't directly addressed, if I'm being argumentative.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the problem is, of course, Supreme Court dicta.
Yeah, it's very strong.
the lower courts, they still view it pretty persuasively, I guess.
Well, that was negative. Let's get positive. The reason I wanted to have both of you on is because, correct me if I'm wrong, you are co-counseling a class action on behalf of TPS applicants for employment authorization. Eddie, can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So this is a case that where the Kurzban firm is co-counseling with NYLA and also with the Northwest Immigrants Rights Project. And it's a certified class action. And the case is really about interim work authorization. So the TPS statute, it provides two main benefits for people that are recipients of TPS, which is reprieve from removal. Someone who's been granted TPS cannot be removed from the United States. And it also provides work authorization. The TPS statute is unique in that there's a statutory provision that guarantees applicants who submit an application establishing their prima facie eligibility that they're entitled to what they call temporary treatment benefits. So they're entitled to interim work authorization and interim reprieves from removal, so long as their TPS applications are pending. And the case really arose because USCIS is just not doing that. You know, during the Trump administration, USCIS adjudications across the board started taking longer and longer and longer. And, TPS was no exception, and people were waiting for many, many months and even years for decisions on their TPS applications. And USCIS simply was not issuing these temporary work authorizations. The adjudications were taking longer than the full period of TPS, and yet no interim work authorization. And so the lawsuit really is trying to get at that issue and to really enforce the statutory requirement that USCIS grant these interim work authorizations to people who file applications that establish their prima facie eligibility.
Prima facie eligibility just really means that on the face, they're eligible. On the face, there's nothing that would bar them, like, for example, multiple criminal convictions. It seems pretty clear to me. I mean, what is even the counter argument? If the statute says you are entitled to benefits while it's pending, then that by definition means that Congress didn't want a non-citizen to have to wait until they actually get TPS to be able to work. So what is even the counter argument besides we are delayed at USCIS?
I mean, that's a great question. The government has an answer. And the government's answer, at least so far in its filings, has been that it's more convenient to simply combine the prima facie determination with the underlying determination as to whether someone merits TPS on the merits.
This is a podcast, so listeners can't see the multitude of faces that Trina is making as I ask the as I ask the very leading question and as Eddie explains it. That's not even a legal argument. Oil is going into federal court and making that as their primary argument?
Well, I mean, just to jump in, oil is doing, or, you know, the district court unit of DOJ is doing what they tend to always do in these cases, right? So they first move to dismiss the class action. You haven't stated a claim. And I think they had an argument about we were out of time because we had to have filed the lawsuit within 6 years of the regulation about prima facie eligibility. But we were all surprised about how blatant USCIS was in the declaration that they were just collapsing the prima facie determination that allows for the statutory benefit of employment documentation with the final merits adjudication. That was surprising. And fortunately, the district court saw through that and denied their motion to dismiss the case and certified the case without even holding oral argument on either motion, which is something that doesn't always happen in these nationwide class actions. And it tells you something about how the district court is looking at the government's arguments.
It's kind of refreshing. I mean, for USCIS and OIL to come in and say, yeah, you got us. This is what we're doing. It would be chaos to do what you're proposing, and we're not doing it. I'm not saying I agree with it. It's refreshing to have some honesty, though, I suppose, from USCIS. I do want to step back, though. Trina or Eddie, what does it mean to have a certified class action, and why is it important to have one in litigation generally, but in immigration litigation specifically?
So a class action is a case that is brought under Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And what it does is it allows certain named plaintiffs to seek relief on behalf of a broader class of people that would benefit if relief were granted. And so even though all of the members of the class, that, you know, you have to have a class definition that identifies what the class is. But the idea is that if you're a member of that class, then you can get the same relief as the named plaintiffs would get, even though you're not actually a plaintiff in the lawsuit. And so it's, you know, class actions are especially important in cases like this, because it's so easy for the government to pick off plaintiffs. You know, we actually, before we joined forces with NYLA and with the Northwest Immigrants Rights Project on this class action, the Kurzban firm partnered up with another firm in Miami, the Canaro Lammers Law Firm, to file a lawsuit with similar claims on behalf of about a dozen plaintiffs. And the government mooted that case within a couple of weeks after we filed the preliminary injunction motion. And, you know, if it's not a class action, once relief is granted to the name plaintiffs, then that's the end of the case because it's moot.
They mooted it by giving the named plaintiffs either work authorization or TPS. So it was great for the named plaintiffs, but not for all the people that they are representing all the other TPS applicants out there who don't have work authorization, who don't have the means to file individual lawsuit in every federal court in the country, which we don't want as lawyers, or the judiciary doesn't want either, right? I mean, that's how they moot it.
Yeah, exactly. And there are certain laws regarding when you take a snapshot of the class of the plaintiff and what counts for standing, and if they actually can moot people out. And the Ninth Circuit law is different. You know, you have to look at your circuit. But just to your point of why is it important in the immigration context, I think it's particularly important because there's so many systemic problems, but the way the immigration bar is stretched with their resources right now, many immigration attorneys are just trying to keep their heads above water with their own dockets, right, with their own cases and their clients that they have responsibilities to. They can't take on these broader systemic problems because they have obligations to their clients. And so with a class action, at least with NILA, what we try to do is we look at sort of big picture issues that affect non-citizens and affect the attorneys who represent them. And we try to come in with class actions that can get some relief. Like we did the Blank Spaces class action.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's worth a donation in and of itself.
Thanks. That was actually brought to us by a NILA member. And then we investigated and thought, hey, this is crazy. And everybody was having a problem with their blank spaces. But you know, to get it fixed kind of required, you know, a class action was helpful in that respect. So
you're talking about the NA that we had to put in these forms during the Trump years, NA in every single space if it wasn't applicable.
Right. Oh, my God. Or have your application rejected.
Oh, my God.
Sent back. It was a nightmare.
No, no big deal. There's just a 1-year asylum 589 filing deadline. It's not a big deal at all.
And we also did the Mendez-Rojas class action with Northwest Immigrants' Rights Project that, you know, for that 1-year filing deadline. So in immigration, it can be helpful to have a class action. But, you know, to Eddie's point, and the way we do it is we take a couple plaintiffs who are representative of the problem. And the significance of class certification is simply that once the class is certified, if any immigration attorney or attorney has a client or the, you know, a non-citizen hears about the certified class, they can just look at the definition and see if they're part of it. And if they are part of the class, then they can benefit from the decision. And that's why in Mansour, the case we're talking about today, when the class was certified, we put that out publicly. We try to get the word out so that attorneys and non-citizens know that there's this case that they can be part of as long as they meet the class definition.
For those listeners who maybe aren't familiar or thinking a bit too deep into this, this is the reason, like, you know, every couple of years you get $6 from Apple or Netflix. It's because some attorney brought a class action somewhere and you are part of that class action, even if you didn't know it, because you fit the description. And of course, you can opt in. And usually it's just a little bit of money for millions of people and the attorneys get a lot of money. But in the immigration realm, it's actually about changing the law, changing a policy. And there isn't usually that much money involved. And you've got nonprofit entities like NILA doing it. We'll be right back after some words from the podcast's sponsors. Are you tired of answering your own phones or of wasting your valuable time on unqualified consultations? Staffy Live is the only 24/7 live receptionist and intake service specialized on immigration law. Staffy Live specialists are highly empathetic, bilingual individuals who know how to deal with adversity, have a background in client care, and are trained to qualify callers by asking the right questions. Staffy Live goes one step ahead in only scheduling qualified consultations on your calendar and then doing follow-ups when needed. Staffy Live is giving a 15-day free trial for any law firm interested with no strings attached. To apply, visit www.getstaffy.com. That's GETSTAFI.com. And click on Get Started. Make sure to put in the code FREE. Links, of course, in the show notes. This podcast is sponsored by Driftwood Capital. Driftwood Capital boasts a 30-plus year track record, transacting on more than $3 billion in hospitality assets. Since 2015, Driftwood Capital has successfully implemented the EB-5 program into their development deals, helping more than 160 families find a secure path to residency through their projects. Driftwood Capital is a vertically integrated commercial real estate firm specializing in hospitality with dedicated acquisitions, development, lending, and management divisions. Their goal is to create long-term partnerships with its network of more than 1,200 active investors from the United States and abroad while targeting attractive returns. Driftwood's unique approach involves managing all aspects in-house, from developing renowned hotel brands such as Marriott, Hilton, and Hyatt, to managing their portfolio of more than 80 hotels in the United States. If you want to learn more about Driftwood Capital, check out the show notes. And of course, let them know who sent you. The Kurzban Law Firm brought a TPS lawsuit a couple of years ago with Mayor Brown and some other entities about the termination of TPS for Haiti. That wasn't a class action. It was an action for declaratory relief. But it had the same effect, that is, nationwide change in an immigration policy. And what we heard a lot from prospective plaintiffs, you still need prospective plaintiffs, was they were scared that if they did this, there would be retribution against them by the U.S. government, or somehow they'd be adversely affected. Have you ever heard that, Trina? And if so, what do you say?
I mean, we have heard that, and each individual plaintiff comes with their own set of concerns and questions and worries. And I think for people who have been in our immigration system hearing the news, that's a valid concern that they have. Why should I bring myself to, you know, put myself in this petition where I'm getting more attention? But in our experience, you know, we try to counsel them before they become a plaintiff and let them know that, you know, there are benefits to being a plaintiff. Oftentimes, your case, the government will try to moot your case, so then they can try to argue that the class action is moot, and then you get the benefit a lot faster than you may otherwise have gotten. But you can't guarantee that nothing bad is going to happen. That's just part of federal court litigation.
Yeah, and the other thing too about class actions is, you know, and this is true of any case, but I think especially with class actions, they can kind of force the government to look at issues. When you file a lawsuit like this, and a team of DOJ lawyers is assigned to it, they have to file something with the court. They have to try to provide some explanation and justify their policy in some way. And in some cases, that can cause them to really look hard at the issue and make changes, you know, even as they continue to litigate the case. You know, and in this TPS case, for example, you know, we've seen reports now that that USCIS is starting to issue interim EADs in at least some types of cases. And we may never know whether that's a direct product of the litigation or not, but this is a pattern that often is seen in these types of cases where they continue to litigate, but they also take some action to make the violations a little bit less blatant than they otherwise might be.
I tell clients as well, I truly believe this too. You know, oil, White House, whoever's litigating it for the government, they still are very competent attorneys, bound by the rules of ethics. And the idea of an oil attorney or a DC or any Department of Justice attorney taking retribution against a named plaintiff because they were part of a lawsuit would not only go against the ethics of being an attorney, but it would give grounds for that non-citizen's attorney to bring a sanctions motion or to really come after that attorney. I think that DOJ is even more careful. It's the opposite. They're even more careful with the named plaintiffs, if anything, than they are desirous of taking retribution. But I'm not sure if you guys agree with that. And of course, I have no proof.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. I agree with that generally.
Trina's, you know, silent with faces.
It hasn't come up for us. We've only really had the experience in our cases where the non-citizen has gotten the benefit, you know, because they have been
right
a class representative.
I think that's telling. I want to end in a second with what's going on in Mansoor, but we kind of just jumped into TPS. Temporary protected status is so interesting and weird, and it's almost its own avenue of immigration. And I know that you guys had to brief a bit about the history of it to bring this case, as federal complaints must do. I don't know, Eddie, could you share a little bit of the history and the weirdness of TPS before we conclude this interview?
I mean, first, I think it's worth commenting on how awesome TPS is. I mean, sure, it's temporary, as the name implies, but first of all, it's available for anyone who meets the definition of the particular TPS designation. So anyone from, unlike asylum, where you're having to make an individualized showing of persecution and, you know, satisfy all the individualized requirements, you know, TPS is a much broader form of relief in that many, many people who are from the country that's designated for TPS will end up qualifying as long as they were here prior to the designation date. And TPS has a number of really great waivers. The statute says you have to be admissible generally, but then there's an automatic exception for a bunch of classes of inadmissibility. And there's a waiver, a very, very generous waiver available for a lot of the other admissibility grounds. And there's a very few that are accepted. I mean, I think it's like Nazi persecutors and a couple of other categories where you can't get.
Now, what is a Nazi persecutor? I would think we'd want people to persecute Nazis. That seems like a group that. A disfavored group in
America. I think the Nazi, I think that's an adjective.
I mean, but also just about the benefits of TPS, the countries that are designated are often countries where there's some type of conflict or environmental disaster or crisis happening. And when a person gets TPS, and if we're successful in our lawsuit, is able to get work authorization early on in the TPS application process because they're prima facie eligible, what that person ends up doing in the United States is working and sending some money back to relatives in that country that is having conflict or emergencies. And it helps the economy of the country that has been designated, because we know non-citizens often send money back to relatives.
And by the way, that money gets taxed before it goes back to the foreign country. So it's really a way to help rebuild a foreign country through individuals working in the American economy and paying taxes on those earnings. The whole thing that you guys are talking about, though, right now, if you were to propose that today, it would be the first thing that got axed in some sort of compromised immigration solution. Eddie, how did it come to be in the first place?
So TPS was part of the Immigration Act of 1990, and it really kind of came out of Congress's effort to codify more ad hoc programs that existed before TPS. So there was this program called Extended Voluntary Departure that had been granted to people from a couple of different nationalities. But the one I think that was most on Congress's mind was El Salvador. I know there was civil conflict in El Salvador, and the administration had granted extended voluntary departure. But as one of the congressmen who promoted the TPS program noted, there was no guaranteed work authorization for people that had extended voluntary departure. They could apply, but there was no guarantee that they would be granted the work authorization. So I have actually a quote from the congressional record here. That it was Congressman Joe Moakley from Massachusetts who said that the old program does not, quote, does not confer any benefit on the people except the prevention of deportation and the opportunity to apply for permission to work. And I stress the word apply. It does not guarantee any way that they may work. Imagine that a congressman today saying that it only prevents deportation and then the bill actually passing. So it was definitely a different era in Congress with respect to immigration.
If Senator Moakley only knew that 34 years later, his words would be uttered on the Immigration Review podcast, I think he probably would have said more words, to be honest with you. That's just in one podcaster's humble opinion.
I agree. And thank you for that quote, Professor Ramos.
That's because Ira makes us do legislative history research when he's mad at us. So, you know, we've got it. It is the worst. It is the worst thing you can do.
The courts used to care too. Now they
used to care. No. Well, I mean, a certain kind of history. I mean, if you can do legislative history from the 18th century, you're golden. The first Congress's record. What are the next steps in Mansoor? How will that affect listeners, clients, those with pending TPS applications? What's happening next?
Sure. So now that we have a nationally certified class, the parties are engaged in some discovery. The government has produced the administrative record. We have served some interrogatories, requests for some further information. We're in a period now where we're waiting to get that information back, and we'll take a look at it, and we may do some depositions. But the next big picture step for this case is that it'll move to the summary judgment phase, and the parties will engage in back and forth briefing, and then the district court likely will schedule a hearing for argument. But this particular judge hasn't done so on the first two motions, and so there's no guarantee. He also may elect to rule in the papers, although that's a little less common when you're talking about summary judgment. So we expect there'll be a hearing, and we will hopefully prevail on our legal claims, and that will put the government in a position where they'll have to figure out how they're going to be getting people employment authorization documentation early on in the application process. But of course, at any point, the government could decide that they want to enter into settlement negotiations so that we can reach, hopefully, a resolution, you know, faster and get TPS applicants work authorization sooner.
Is there any chance that the USCIS director will assert that she has blanket immunity from all lawsuits and take that challenge all the way up to the Supreme Court so as to stall your case, asking for a friend? is that a possibility?
Never say never.
Indeed.
If individuals have questions about this lawsuit or questions about how it can help their clients, Trina, how can they reach you? We're going to put it in the show notes, but if people don't read the show notes, how can they reach you?
They can email info@immigrationlitigation.org, or they can email me directly at trina@immigrationlitigation.org. They can email Eddie, and they can also, work on this case with my colleagues, Mary Kenny and Kristen McLeod Ball. And then we have a great team from the Northwest Immigrants Rights Project, Matt Adams and Arian Corthius and Layla Kang and Glenda Madriel Aldana. So we have a really, you know, there's a lot of people at these organizations that would be more than happy to answer people's questions if they have questions about the case.
How would they email you, Eddie?
Just eramos@kktplaw.com.
You said that so quick. Thank you both so much for all of this, and really for all you guys do at NILA. Trina, is there anything else you'd like to say about NILA or this class action or immigration litigation in general or the future or anything before we go? speak your mind. It doesn't even have to be immigration related. Tell me about your family. No, I'm just whatever you want to talk about.
Noah, thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate the chance to talk about some of our casework, to talk about what we're trying to do. We very much are an organization that it wants to help the immigration bar. We sort of understand the stress that they are under, the pressures and the caseloads. And, you know, I guess I will say that I think imposter syndrome is a real thing that immigration attorneys and other attorneys face. Like, they don't think they can go to federal court. They shouldn't be here. There are people who are smarter than them. You know, I suffer from it. A lot of people do. And I hope that your listeners will think about whatever their individual personal goal is to try to achieve. If they want to litigate in federal court, know that we're here to try to help them do that. But it might not be that. It's just really important in this crazy area that we practice in that people continue to challenge themselves and learn different skill sets, because really it gets harder every day. And the more you learn and the more you're comfortable with doing, I think the better it is for your clients. So
to say it again, for me, the only way around over imposter syndrome or wanting to throw up every time I go into court or anything like that is to be prepared, knowing the rules, to be able to tell yourself in the mirror, I know what I'm doing. I'm here for a reason. And that's just preparedness. I don't know, knowing the facts, knowing the law, knowing the rules. And so that's exactly what Nyla seems to be doing for the immigration bar, is giving all of those skills so you can have confidence.
We do a lot of moot courts.
You do a lot of moot. Moot courts is vital. Moot is vital. So thank you. How about you, Eddie?
No, I don't really have any.
that's going in. That's I mean, this is the last.
But can we find a way to mention Chris Rickard somehow?
Chris Rickard needs no mention on this podcast. I think Chris has done a guest host. Chris, yes, let's talk about Chris Rickard. Chris is one of the people I respect most in this whole world, and I know he's a listener. So Chris, when you listen to this, send us an email. Who would like to talk about Chris?
He does work as a special projects attorney with Nyla. So he is a delight, and he is one of the people who will moot Nyla members.
He's mooted me.
And Chris is still a KKTP consultant. He consults with us from time to time. So he's
a jack of many trades.
Yes.
Exactly. He's brilliant. Everybody we've been talking about really during this call is brilliant. And I'm sure there are lots. I know that there are lots of people out there who are as well, who will be noticed eventually. I do feel like Chris is kind of like an under the radar guy in the immigration community. So I'm always happy to promote him.
And Trina, how can people get involved with Nyla? Like if someone's like attracted to everything that you're saying about Nyla, what can they do?
They could check out our website to see what cases we have happening in the hopper, and a little sneak preview that we've got another class action coming in the next couple of weeks. Stay tuned. And they could come visit us in Chicago at the AILA conference if they're going to be there, because we're going to have a booth and a reception. And so we would love to meet people and tell them a little bit more about what we do in person.
Links in the show notes. Thank you both for spending time with me tonight. It was a pleasure. Thank you both for all that you do. You two are both some of the smartest people I know, so it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me back, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all, and follow the show on Instagram and Facebook at Immigration Review, or send us a tweet at imreview, that's I-M-M, review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review. We'll be right back.